Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Enough Project conference call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star zero. At this time, it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Eileen Reed. Ma'am, the floor is yours.
Good morning. This is Eileen Reed speaking. I handle media relations at the Enough Project. Our executive director, John Norris, will be speaking first, and then John Prendergast, co-founder of the Enough Project, and then Professor David Crane, who is the former founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. John Norris?
Yeah, thank you, everyone, for joining us. John Prendergast will talk a little bit about the impact on Sudanese politics, the likely fallout of the warrant. David, with his extensive experience in international justice, we'll touch on what this means in terms of the broader context for international justice and how this will likely unfold as we go forward. And I just want to add a few comments on top. I think this is a very good day for international justice. I think it's a very good day for improved prospects for peace in Sudan. That there's a lot of commentators and a lot of folks out there whose first reaction in the face of a warrant, or in this case, for war crimes and crimes against humanity, it suggests that the situation on the ground will get worse, that peace will somehow become impossible, that everything will be more difficult and more risky. And I think that simply isn't borne out by the international experience today. Clearly, there's no obvious vehicle to deliver Bashir to the court immediately. But as we've seen with Charles Taylor, as we've seen with Slobodan Milosevic, as we've seen with the more than 50 people who were convicted by the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, justice does find a way. And this really does give a clear stamp from the international community that the crimes, the heinous crimes that have occurred in Darfur, can be traced in a bright and direct line back to the presidential palace in Khartoum. And really, we think that it makes peace much more possible and much more likely, because it's the first time that President Bashir has actually been held accountable for any of his actions. And it's the first time that he's faced a significant cost from the international community for his divisive and deadly divide and conquer style of politics, both in Darfur and in the earlier civil war with the South. So I think it really is an important day. I think that clearly everybody who's looked at Darfur, who's worked on the ground in Sudan, really doesn't have a lot of question or doubt that those activities that have taken place, the organizing of the Janjaweed, the attacks on civilians, were organized by the government and organized by the government intelligence services at the highest level. So in some ways, I think the court is to be congratulated for handing down a decision that clearly identifies the problem and clearly holds President Bashir culpable. John, do you want to touch a little bit on what this means for Sudan as we go forward?
Thank you. You know, three kind of groups, one inside Darfur, second, the surrounding region, some of the connections and alliances that the government of Sudan has and the impact this war will have, and then thirdly, on the internal domestic situation, hopefully in 2 minutes. First, inside Darfur, I've been in there 8 times now in the last 5 years. And in those 8 visits, we found from interviewing countless numbers of displaced and war-affected Darfurians, they don't see a tension between justice and peace. And they feel that it would be impossible to have peace without justice. And that these refugees and displaced people that have been the sort of the visible impact of the crimes against humanity that have unfolded in Darfur put the problem, I think, in the clearest of terms. One after the other tells you, how can you have peace when the president of Sudan has tried to exterminate us? And it's interesting that one of the counts, and David can speak more about this, was extermination. Regionally, I think Bashir's troubles are mounting, though you're not going to see this play out on the pages of newspapers or in press conferences, I think. His staunchest supporters are backing away from him slowly. China is deeply concerned about its oil investments and how they might be put at risk by Bashir's continued warmongering and the isolation that he will increasingly realize as a result of this. Warrant and Arab states have very similar concerns about their own huge investments in the oil-fueled economic boom that exists in Sudan. Egypt in particular, I think, sees Bashir as a liability, given Bashir's support for the assassination attempt against Mubarak in 95, then his support for Saddam Hussein in the two Gulf Wars, and then finally his support for Hamas now. I think the Egyptians are fed up. President Mubarak sees the Islamist movement in Sudan as the most dangerous in the region, and his patience has simply run out. Finally, thirdly, inside Sudan, inside the capital, tensions, I think, are boiling within the government in response to these challenges and particularly in response to this warrant. Some insiders within the regime want to find an exit strategy for Bashir, whether that involves some kind of retirement or standing him down in advance of upcoming elections. I don't think he'll be humiliated, but I do think that there is a sentiment that says we don't want, going into the elections in 2000, later in 2009, we don't want an indicted war criminal as our candidate. This group would then shift, if they could manage, a replacement towards greater accommodation with the international community, which then gives us more opening for peace. But there are other voices, as there always are, that are much more hardline, wanting to impose martial law, withdraw from the North-South peace deal, and you're going to see some probably fairly substantial reprisals against some of the NGOs, the humanitarian groups in the coming weeks. So I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that millions of Sudanese lives in Darfur and in the South are hanging in the balance on which group emerges victorious in regards to whether a new tack is taken of accommodation or whether escalation is the rule of the day. And how the Obama administration handles all this is going to have a major impact on the outcome. And we can talk about that in the discussion. David, go ahead.
Well, thank you, John. Both John Norris and John Pendergast. I think it's been not only an amazing day, but just to put it in a real brief context, an amazing week. Last Wednesday, we started out this amazing 7 days with the conviction of the leadership of the Revolutionary United Front, whom I indicted back in March of 2003. And we saw convictions for not only child soldiers and, for the first time in history, attacks on UN peacekeepers, but one that is very important and significant, and that is a new crime against humanity, which we drafted called forced marriage in times of armed conflict. We also saw last week on Friday the prosecution team from the Special Court for Sierra Leone rest its case against former President Charles Taylor, the first African head of state ever to be indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. On Sunday, we see the International Administrative Tribunal for Lebanon start the process in the case of for the assassination of Hariri. And then, of course, today we see the arrest warrant of the sitting president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. Just to put this quickly in context, I mean, just 10 years ago, this would have all been a legal theory, and I know that John Norris and John Pendergast would echo me on this. We have moved incredibly, though sometimes fitfully, and I'm certainly not defending it as perfect, but we have made great strides in the movement of facing down what I call the beast of impunity. This indictment today, in my opinion, as it did when I unsealed the indictment against President Charles Taylor in June of 2003, will bring peace. I agree with John. I think that the president of Sudan's political support will begin to soften and dry up as people pull away, because no one wants to be seen or dealing with an indicted war criminal. But the Taylor case, the parallels between the first indictment against the sitting head of state, Charles Taylor, and Omar al-Bashir are striking. There was a peace process. We have the indictment. We see diplomats and politicians seeking solutions to deal with the indictment. We see Taylor's, and we'll probably see Bashir's, political support unraveling. There was a solution made, and Taylor, and I'm sure Bashir eventually will be forced to move in some kind of political accommodation at first. But then what more importantly is that the peace process truly began to move forward, either the comprehensive peace process that we have in Sudan or the Accra Peace Accords that were just starting when I unsealed the indictment the day it started back in June of 2003. And that peace process that was begun with the indictment of Charles Taylor ended up with the election of first female head of state in the history of Africa, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And Liberia now is on at least a tentative road to potentially a sustainable peace. So this is an incredible week, an incredible day for international criminal law, but it's also an important day, and we always have to remember that this is for and about the victims of these horror stories that we were discussing, and that justice, though imperfect, moves forward, and this whole process has been capped by the arrest warrant that was issued this morning. So with that, I will finish, and I look forward to a good dialogue.
Eileen, do you want to moderate the questions? How's this next step going?
The operator is supposed to come back on, but we'll go ahead and start. Is Scott Baldoff on the call?
Ma'am, would you like me to open the floor for questions?
Yes, please, operator.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. If at any time your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing #. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions. Our first question comes from Isabel Coelho, an Africa correspondent. Please state your question.
My question is, what do you think about the fact that the genocide charge has not been accepted at this stage by the judges? My second question would be, what is now the biggest nut to crack in terms of lobbying? Will it be China? Will it be the U.S., which abstained from the referral at the Security Council? Thank you very much.
David, do you want to handle the first part of that question, and then John and I can handle the second half?
That'll be fine. Well, again, I don't think it's a moment to take to be disheartened by the fact that that the charge of genocide was not returned. The issue being is, has the gravamen of the offenses against the people of Darfur still been framed in the indictment? And the answer is, it has. Be mindful of semantic issues related to what we call what has been going on. There's still some debate as to whether it was or was not a genocide. But at the end of the day, the end result is we have a prosecution for the horror story that was Darfur, and that if they go forward with the various parts of the charges, the facts will come out, and that the world will know what the president of Sudan has done, as well as his cohorts. And the key to these types of international prosecutions, as we did in West Africa, is to ensure that the world understands and appreciates through the delivery of facts in a courtroom exactly what took place, and then that there's accountability based on that. So the fact that the genocide charge was not brought back, that's not something that will prevent justice from being done. Genocide is a tough charge to prove, and it's I think a good example that the International Criminal Court has looked at this coldly, soberly, fairly, and openly, and they've allowed a movement forward with an indictment that is supportable. And in reality, you will see the facts that have played out over the past many years, and Bashir and his henchmen's role in it, will still come out, and the prosecutor has said he has a strong case, and should there be a conviction, then the world will know what has happened in Darfur, and that there will be a solid historical record as well as a legal record as to what took place.
Now, the issue of the deferral, this is John Doris. I think there is zero momentum for invoking Article 16 at this point, in large part because I think the U.S. has been a staunch supporter of the court moving forward. I think that there is very little sentiment from Susan Rice at the UN, from Secretary of State Clinton at the State Department, from President Obama, who's spoken very forcefully on the situation in Darfur, to give Sudan a free pass at this point. And the other reason that there is very little momentum for a deferral is frankly the actions of President Bashir. He has been fiercely unapologetic. He has made no concrete or demonstrable steps towards peace. His intelligence and security officials are threatening to cut off limbs of people who speak out in favor of the court in Khartoum. Bashir himself said that the court could eat its warrant yesterday. There have been continued aerial attacks from the Sudanese government in Darfur in violation of numerous UN resolutions and breaking any number of commitments, and not a single sign that Sudan's government is serious about peace, about allowing IDPs and refugees to return home, and absent those conditions, why in God's name would anyone consider a deferral? Deferral in Article 16 can only be invoked in extraordinary circumstances and in the broader interest of peace, and it's clear right now that the government of Sudan isn't interested in peace, and thus there is no need, I think, to even consider Article 16.
And to the question of China, and it's definitely the most difficult diplomatic nut to crack, as you're asking, I think, and the opportunity really exists here for the United States and China to work together on the thing that they do agree on. They certainly don't agree on the Article 16 invocation, as China will continue to half-heartedly introduce conversations in New York at the Security Council in favor of it just to appease and satisfy its commercial partner in Khartoum. But they do share, the U.S. And China share an interest in peace in Darfur and peace in the South. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity now for the Obama administration to name its special envoy, get that envoy out into the field, and one of his or her first visits ought to be to Beijing to talk to the Chinese about how we can work together on securing, on supporting the securing of a peace deal in Darfur and the implementation of the CPA.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Olivia Ward, a foreign affairs writer. Please state your question.
Hello. I'd like to ask probably John Pendergast, what will happen if Bashir were to be ousted? What are the other possibilities, and do you think that they would really be significantly better?
Yeah, I think that we know illusions about who, this is a cabal, a junta, you know, it's a group of people who make a who make the major decisions, and Bashir is the face of that cabal. He is not, his voice is not any more powerful than, say, his head of security, Salah Ghosh, or his presidential advisor, Nafi al-Nafi. These are the three probably most important actors, along with the defense minister. And so I think that if there was a replacement engineered, I think it would be a consensus position that would be secured within the ruling party's leadership, as opposed to two. And I think that it would be done with the international relations in mind, with other states that otherwise will have a tremendous problem with conducting business as usual with a regime headed by an indicted war criminal, as David said. So I think it's much better. I think that the opportunity, if Bashir is replaced, is much better for a peace deal than if he stays, because I think that there can be some measure of placing the sins of the regime on this current head of state, and then moving him aside and pursuing a more accommodationist route. That is clearly the best case scenario, but one that can be influenced by a very strong and united international response to this indictment. If no one backs it up by downgrading their relations with this regime, if none of the major ICC supporters, particularly in Europe, do anything about it, then certainly it will probably continue to be business as usual for the Sudanese regime. They probably will continue to do what John is just describing in terms of the escalation of attacks. If there is no response but a few speeches by people in New York or other places. But if there is a very significant repercussion, even if it is a slight downgrade in diplomatic relations, this matters greatly to this government. It's not the Taliban. They don't want to be isolated. And so this would be the cost that would actually influence the behavioral change and potentially a change in leadership. And so that I think in itself will be one of the principal drivers for a more accommodationist, more flexible position on the part of the government over the course of the next year with respect to peace negotiations, which puts the onus of responsibility on the international community, particularly the Obama administration, to A, ensure that there is a strong response to the indictment or to the arrest warrant, and then B, that there is a follow-up effort to bring about a peace deal in Darfur that is much more focused and comprehensive than the existing one. Next one.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Margaret Bashir of the Enough Project. Please state your question.
I think they got there on it from Voice of America. I'm just wondering, first of all, can they try Bashir in absentia at the ICC, and how long will the case take? And also, how does this impact now the other cases with Haroon and Kashayev? I mean, in terms of Article 16, do you think they might be more amenable to turning them over now and maybe getting a 16 for Bashir, or how do you think that's going to play out?
David, that sounds like it's perfectly up your alley.
Yes, well, there is no trial in absentia in modern international criminal law, so he'll have to be personally present for his trial. Which at the end of the day will take place. This is now a process that will be beginning, which John Pendergast, I think, very correctly pointed out. The politicians and diplomats now are going to have to conform their conduct to now this indictment that's on the table. And so work is already and has already been working on what do we do now with him. And so we'll eventually see him set aside, and then he will be handed over to the court. This may take weeks, months, it could even take years, as in the Charles Taylor case. As to the other indictments, certainly one can do one of several things. One can join them, as we say, as we did in the West African Tribunal, where we had three joint criminal trials against the leadership of the warring factions. So those indictments could be joined and have one joint criminal trial with Bashir and others. That's a possibility, but that's a decision that's made by the prosecutor. I think it'd be an efficient way to do it because it's the same evidence, same witnesses, what have you. So be looking for that. I don't think if they would try them one at a time. But I don't think the Article 16 idea, which I fully agree with John Norris and John Prendergast, I know of no real, other than from various factions in the African Union, I know of no real political interest at this point of going down that road. I think that they're going to allow the indictment to stand and let the political process, because now, in some ways, ladies and gentlemen, this is really now a political process that's about to start, not a legal one. The legal work has been done. The indictment's been drafted, the case is prepared, the chamber has issued an arrest warrant. Now it is up to the obligations of the state parties to turn the indicted war criminals over for an open and fair trial. That will be a political decision with political arrangements being made, particularly since one of the indictees is a sitting head of state.
And in light of that, this is John Prendergast, in light of that political kind of next phase that we're just beginning now, to try to zero in on the question, I don't believe that those that are against the invocation of Article 16 now will be impressed with, at this late point, the Sudanese government handing in the two other suspects, sort of trading them for the indictment of Bashir. So I don't think that's on the table. I think the only thing that people would give people pause and potentially be a catalytic moment for the use of the Article 16 would be if a peace deal was actually signed in for Darfur and there was actually the beginning of the implementation. I think then you look at the ICC charter in the interest of peace and you could see the possibility of a significant debate amongst those that have held out so far against Article 16 about whether or not to invoke it at that point. And again, as David said, that's a political decision, not necessarily any kind of an empirical or automatic trigger for of one kind of issue or another. It's definitely a political process. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joe Loria of the Wall Street Journal. Please state your question.
Yes, I'd like to ask John Prendergast what he makes of criticism out of Africa and elsewhere. But this is essentially white justice or Eurocentric justice, if you've never seen an American or European leader being indicted like this, a similar crime.
No, I think that the prosecutor is attempting, and the states so far involved in ICC cases are attempting to address the three big ticket items that the ICC was created to address: genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And three of the first four cases have been the governments themselves referring the cases. In the case of Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, and Uganda, it's not like these are European states referring these cases. It is the governments themselves that have chosen as signatories to the ICC to refer some fairly extraordinary crimes that are being committed in their territories to the tribunal. The only one that wasn't a government itself, government referred case, was this case of Darfur, which the Security Council referred to years ago. And I know that the prosecutor is examining evidence on a few other cases. I'm sure David can talk a little more about it. I'd love if you would, David. But that it is, I think we're going to see 10 years from now a fairly global reach on the part of this court. It's beginning where it's got the opportunities, which is where governments themselves have actually referred cases. And in the case of Sudan, a highly political process led to the Security Council, against many predictions, actually referring the case. So it is a very, very difficult process to get the Security Council to agree unanimously to refer a case. So, David, do you want to say anything more about this?
Well, yeah, there is no sinister plot or a major focus on just Africa. John very correctly points out that almost all of the cases that have been referred to the ICC have been done through the Security Council or state party referral. The prosecutor hasn't referred something by himself yet. He's only been doing what he's been asked to do, and I think that's important to note. And he's certainly involved in other investigations worldwide. Colombia just comes to mind. So again, I agree with John. In 10 years, we will see as this new court, and we have to underscore this new court, this new permanent court, begins to flex its wings, we'll see that it will be seeking appropriate cases throughout the world. So I think it's a matter of circumstance and not intent. I just like to point out that there were 20 African countries that were the founders of the International Criminal Court, and I think currently there are 30 that are states parties. So again, Africa has stepped up to the plate. Africa is ready to seek justice for victims. And they certainly have done so by signing on to the International Criminal Court. Again, I would just underscore that it's circumstance, not intent, as far as the way this has been going this far.
And I would, this is John Norris, I would just add to that, certainly if you look at the case of the former Yugoslavia, and that was done by an ad hoc tribunal before the ICC was created, but there I think we see that European states, those in North America, were equally tough on demanding justice, regardless of the color of anyone's skin. That we've seen more than 50 prosecutions across the former Yugoslavia. I think in almost every one of the successor states of the former Yugoslavia, there was intense pressure by the European Union to turn over indicted war criminals as a precondition for moving towards membership in the European Union. And I think that the application of justice really does not fall disproportionately on any one continent or the other. And I think what we're seeing is a shared sentiment around the globe that impunity simply is no longer credible in this day and age, and that any country and any leader that engages in wholesale attacks on their own civilians and on their own population will be held accountable.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Neil McFarquhar, a UN correspondent. Please state your question.
Hi, good morning. I have two questions, one technical and one analytical. The first one is a technical. Are other states in the region accountable for arresting Bashir if he attended an Arab summit or if he went to peace conference in Doha, Qatar, something like that? Are they under any obligation to arrest him? That's the first question. The second one, since the possibility of indictment has been first broached, there's been kind of a sentiment in the UN that the Sudanese government has been more amenable. They have been more cooperative with UNAMID deployment issues and things like that, and they also did attend the peace talks in Doha. So do you see, now that it's been, the warrant has been handed down, will they continue that and try and find ways to cooperate, or will they go the other way and just sort of kind of evolve away from any kind of cooperation, go back to their belligerent, more belligerent stance that had in the past?
Well, we'll go ahead and address the arrest obligation issue. When one is indicted as a war criminal, be it through the ad hoc tribunals or the hybrid tribunals or in the International Criminal Court, all parties that are members of the United Nations or states parties to their own statute do have an obligation to arrest and to turn over to the International Criminal Court anybody who is indicted for an appropriate and fair trial. So,
but if they're not signatories to their own statute, so that doesn't matter? I mean, if they're not...
Well, actually, you know, it really doesn't matter. You know, the Geneva Conventions back in 1949 go all the way back to state that when one commits war crimes, there's an obligation by anyone, all nations, to investigate, arrest, and to prosecute or hand over to an appropriate party to prosecute anyone. So the concept and the process has been around for many, many decades, and the current modern international criminal law still reflects this obligation. So the indictments now really, from a practical point of view, box in President Bashir. Because certainly no state is going to allow him to land in their territory knowing that they have an obligation to do something. It would be very embarrassing and also a slap in the face of international justice, or at least laying down a marker saying, here's how we feel about this indictment, to allow Bashir to travel anywhere because, again, of this all-encompassing obligation to arrest and hand over, which has always been a problem, ladies and gentlemen, related to international criminal justice, and that is the legal process moves forward like we've seen. Then again, it's the political decision as to what we do with that legal process. And again, the handover of a sitting head of state or any war criminal, in most instances, political decision. So prison arrest obligation, and so it'll be interesting to see if he travels at all.
I think, Neil, it's John Prendergast. I think, like Mugabe, he will test it, and there'll be some non-signatory states who will gladly welcome him to thumb their nose at these kinds of institutions. But I think, in general terms, anyone who's been a signatory would follow what David is saying, but I do think there are some states that would be happy to have him come just to make some kind of a symbolic statement against this kind of world government. On your second question, I think we're going to see an increase, of course, in rhetoric, like what we saw with Solid Ghost the other day, talking about beheading anyone who supports this thing. And I think we'll see, in practical terms on the ground, increased witch hunts, particularly within the relief agencies and Darfur civil society, human rights, or civil rights groups. Anyone who cooperated in any way, shape, or form with the ICC investigation, or even those that they don't want anymore in the country, they're going to accuse of having cooperated with the ICC. And we'll see expulsions and, in some cases, probably arrest and torture if they're Sudanese. And I think so that is definitely going to, we've already seen an increase in that in the week or two before the announcement today. But on the broader political questions with respect to UNAMID deployment, with respect to their negotiating posture in Doha or wherever the follow-on negotiations end up being, especially if the United States gets involved in a more direct way, and with respect to the comprehensive peace agreement between the North and the South, you're going to see the potential for a much more amenable position on the part of Khartoum for two reasons. I think number one, Bashir himself has a vested interest in being seen to be more moderate is his only ticket. And again, it's all political, as David said, so no one can tell us for sure if or if not he will ever get a Article 16 deferral, but I can tell you his chances increase astronomically for a deferral if he is able to secure a peace deal for in Darfur. And if he is replaced or retired, and his whoever comes in behind him, and there's a discussion about that now within the ruling regime, within the ruling party, then similarly, this will blunt the possibility of Ocampo bringing further arrest warrants, further cases against other senior members of the National Congress Party. So I think we're going to, unless, and the one thing that can clear the mist is if there is no response for the international community, if there's a big shoulder shrug in response to this arrest warrant, and the Sudanese government sees once again that it's words and not action that the international community is bringing to the situation, then I think we will see some escalation and intensification on the ground in Darfur, some pulling back on implementation of the CPA, particularly preparation for referendum and elections, and of course in back to the old ways of obstruction with respect to UNAMID. But you're right, there has been some incremental changes in terms of the practical interactions that the government on a day-to-day basis has with internationals on some issues. And I do think that is a reflection of the leverage that the arrest warrant is going to provide to the international community should they choose to use it to gain some fairly significant progress on some of the intractable issues that have plagued the country over the last couple of years.
And I would just add, this is John Norris again, that I think this is a mistake that kind of armchair analysts make again and again. They made it in former Yugoslavia looking at Milosevic, in Liberia looking at Taylor, and in Sudan looking at Bashir, and assuming that an arrest warrant or indictment will make the president completely belligerent. And I think the indictee in that position understands that they need to be belligerent enough to try to control their internal opposition, but if they really do become maximalist, if they start going after UN peacekeepers, if they go on a wholesale offensive, they will only effectively galvanize a more forceful international response. And I think that there are a lot of people in Bashir's own party who understand that probably as well or even better than Bashir. So I think they'll test the fences, as John Prendergast rightly points out. They'll be antagonistic if there's no effective international response, but I think that they understand that the stakes have really risen dramatically today, and that if they continue the practices that they have in the past, they will face an escalating cost for that behavior.
Next question.
Moderate. Thank you.
That's okay.
Our next question is from Marissa Buchanan, a producer. Please state your question.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on something that was mentioned earlier. What are your thoughts on the next steps for the Obama administration and how they reconcile not technically recognizing the ICC and supporting this arrest warrant going forward? And then also, in terms of an envoy that's been bantered about a little bit, what do you think of the timetable for that? For the U.S.
John, do you want to go ahead?
You got the first one. I'll take the second one. On the envoy, I do know that in the aftermath, ironically, of a visit by everyone's favorite Hollywood Darfur activist to the White House last Monday. When Clooney came out afterwards and announced to the press that the administration was going to name a special envoy, that certainly accelerated the timetable in a positive way for the naming of a senior official. So we have, I think, in the works a fairly intensive process within the administration, both the policy review, which, you know, every administration does on high-profile issues anyways as a matter of course, which will be concluded soon, and the search for the right person to do the job of special envoy and a team that would go with that person. So I think it's all coming soon, and I think it's unfortunate that it was not in place today. So they could start from this extraordinary opportunity of leverage that is provided by the arrest warrant to actually start working. But I think it will come soon. I think people are, as they say, seized of the matter, and I think that the search will be concluded soon, hopefully, and we'll get somebody named and in the game. But go ahead and get the first question there, Johnny.
Yeah, and in terms of how the administration approaches the broader issues of international justice and whether it supports the court or not, I think in a lot of ways can be effectively disentangled from this specific case. Clearly, the big issues with Bashir are what is the Obama administration's approach on Article 16? I think they've been clear that they will not support a deferral. Are they willing to put in place a senior special envoy and try to lead a coordinated and strategic peace process that looks not only at the situation in Darfur, but at the badly framed North-South peace agreement? Are they willing to hold partners' feet to the fire on Bashir and on the peace process? Are they willing to have smart and strategic diplomacy with the Chinese and other economic partners in Sudan to make the case that stability can best be achieved without Bashir at this point? And I think those issues really are, in a lot of ways, separate from the much longer and detailed review that the State Department and others say that they're going to conduct on the administration's position towards the court. That involves a lot of complicated issue, including the treatment of U.S. servicemen serving in peacekeeping operations or in military operations of their own. I think that will take a great deal of time before they land on a position, and I know that David, I'm sure, can speak on this and appreciate it better than I do. There's an awful lot of complicated legal issues from Geneva Conventions to Guantanamo to the International Criminal Court that the administration is going to have to give a very thoughtful and very comprehensive review to. So I don't think Sudan policy necessarily needs to get caught in that trap.
Operator?
Dave.
Our next question comes from Matthew Lee, a reporter for Inner City Press. Please state your question.
Yes, hello. I wanted to ask, a lot, I'm a reporter at the UN, and a lot of issues have arisen about whether the two UN peacekeeping missions, UNMID and UNMISS, provided information in any way that led to the indictment. And so one of the issues, I just wanted to know if you guys could speak to whether you think that the indictment has any potential to make it less likely in the future that a leader or, you know, a person like Bashir would consent to a UN peacekeeping mission coming in. And also just in light of the sort of the very positive spin, what do you think that the indictment of Joseph Kony has, in general, led to more peace or less? And what do you think the Cambodia tribunal seems kind of mired in trouble? I didn't hear that in the sort of the list of great tribunals. So if you could address those, I'd appreciate it.
Johnny, I'll take the Kony part.
David, why don't you start out with the Cambodia piece?
Oh, yeah.
Well, again, the Cambodia Tribunal is a politically constructed attempt to seek some justice for a horror story that took place. This is one of those steps by mankind to try to seek some justice, not perfect justice. And certainly, the way it has been set up, it is a Cambodian court with international presence. It is going to be injected with a great deal of politics, particularly since individuals who are culpable or are part of the tragedy move about the court and move about the area all the time. But at the end of the day, quite modern criminal justice is politics, and it is a smart prosecutor and is a smart diplomat or politician that understands that, lives with that, and works with the idea that there is issues related to peace and justice. I don't call it peace versus justice because both actually have to happen. Sometimes peace first then justice, or sometimes justice then peace, but certainly does bring a long-term and a possibility of a sustainable peace.
In terms of the UN peacekeeping mission question, you know, it's a reasonable question. I don't think President Bashir accepted a very watered-down UNAMID because of his great love for peace or his desire to bring stability to Darfur. I think he accepted and negotiated down the terms of the peacekeeping mission as a way to, in an effort to preclude justice, in an effort to preclude more effective peace talks or negotiations or a more sensible approach to what was going on the ground. So, you know, obviously every leader has to make some hard decisions about whether a peacekeeping mission should be put in place. And I would hope that the UN and the Security Council does a better job of only being willing to authorize peacekeeping missions that have the basic hallmarks in place to succeed in their mission. And I think there were a lot of concerns rightly expressed at the highest levels of the UN, particularly in DPKO, as UNAMID was being formed, that it was not designed to succeed. And I think what we've seen on the ground is that those assessments were exactly right. So, as to the evidence question, you know, I think that the killings and what has happened in mass displacement in Darfur have been so clearly orchestrated from Khartoum that the Janjaweed has so clearly been a proxy militia for the government of Sudan that I think the prosecutor probably had an embarrassment of riches as far as evidence goes. So I don't know if he did or not rely on evidence proof presented or provided by peacekeepers, but certainly he had numerous sources to receive evidence.
Just real quickly, the UN does have a support agreement with the ICC, and the part of that support agreement does authorize and allow the free exchange of information to the International Criminal Court. But that's not something extraordinary. That is just a logical follow-on on the obligation of all states, parties, and nations to support war crimes prosecutions.
Just one, if you don't mind, just because I'm just going through the Coney thing, I just want to say there was a press conference here by the head of peacekeeping, Alain Leroy, and he went out of his way to say all the UN in Sudan provided were regularly written reports, i.e. to the Security Council, that they say, it's their claim that they make no investigations for the ICC, and they put out press releases from on this, you know, to that effect. So I might like, for example, Somalia, there's supposed to be a peacekeeping mission. If you can imagine the new leader of Somalia saying, yes, we'll have you in, only if you commit not to provide evidence about what we've done here. You know what I mean? That's all I meant. And then I'll be quiet. I just meant in future peacekeeping missions, whether this unresolved question of whether evidence would be provided to the ICC might make it less likely for a leader to say, sure, come in.
I don't think it's unresolved, Matthew. It is resolved. They are not, as a matter of their mandate, authorized to be sharing information or executing any of the supporting the activities of the ICC beyond just the reports that we've, you know, the regular reporting to the Security Council. I don't think this is going to be, and I think for the reasons you're raising, that you're not going to see the Security Council try to add to the mandates of these peacekeeping missions an additional activity of quietly providing information and garnering and providing information for the International Criminal Court, because nobody will invite them in that case. So certainly you've hit the nail on the head, and now if there are individuals that are providing that, we don't have that information, but certainly as a matter of policy. Sorry to interrupt you, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think the question is somewhat upside down. I mean, I think the real lesson going forward for our leaders is that if there's a ongoing UN operation on the ground, if there's international attention, you shouldn't keep committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. and that you can't do so with impunity. And that will increasingly be the case whether or not there is a UN operation on the ground. And so I think the real lesson and the real problem is the ongoing conduct of war crimes, not the international mechanisms for responding to them.
Oh, that's true, and again, it's underscored, and please don't get the impression what I was saying was the peacekeeping forces that are out in the field are not police arms of any criminal court, but logical back and forth of providing information that they stumble on or they were to provide goes through, obviously, the UN headquarters, and a decision is made to give it to them. But, yeah, certainly we don't have, and I agree with the head of DPKO, we don't have police. UN is not being a police force for the ICC, indeed.
Just one last follow-up, I'm sorry, just because it's sort of you've gotten down to it. The reason that there was unresolved is that there was this case, the Thomas Lubanga case of the ICC, in which DPKO asked for confidential treatment for information they provided against Thomas Lubanga, and they said that it shouldn't be shared with the defense. So it was pretty clear that that wasn't information that was just given to the Security Council, because then they wouldn't have asked to withhold it. So I mean, maybe it's an evolution. That's all. I think it is an unresolved question. That's all.
I think in the case of Congo, where you have it's very interesting. Maybe you've stumbled onto something, or maybe you've identified something and I've stumbled behind you, but that in the case of a referral, as we've seen in Sudan, by the Security Council, where the state party, where the sovereign government is opposed to the ICC's involvement, that of course there have been strict firewalls between UNMISS and UNIM and any kind of information sharing with the ICC, because it would obviously threaten and compromise the peacekeeping forces on the ground in both those missions. However, in Congo, where the state party has referred the case to the ICC, there may have been, and in the Lubanga case there was, interactions between the Mono Commission and provision of information to the ICC specific to the case of this particular indictee. So that's an interesting division between those cases that are referred by the state party and those cases that are referred by the Security Council, but I have no idea if David or John may, if there's a codified policy of the Security Council and of the United Nations Secretariat with respect to information sharing and the differences between those two kinds of missions.
It's brought to my experience with the other tribunals and stuff. We have various articles that allow for the confidential moving back and forth of information requested by the by that particular court, be it an ad hoc or a hybrid, and it's up to the state to determine whether they can or want to release information that they may or may not want to have public, but may be useful as far as other aspects of the investigation.
Thanks.
Okay, next question.
Sir, there appear to be no further questions at this time.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, well, yeah, thanks everybody for coming on, and obviously follow up with us if you've got any other questions or queries throughout the day, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks, David, for doing with us.
Oh, our pleasure, and obviously we'll be chatting about other things, but just have a good day, and if you need to reach out to me, I'll be in my office generally. If there's any follow-on questions or if you want a particular report or whatever, I'm available.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. Bye now.
Bye. See ya.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time and have a great day.